What I'd like to do is begin by just finding out what everybody's name is, just so we share names and what we're going to remember, but just to know who we're working with while we're together for this period of time. So I think we'll start that off. I am Norm Metzler, Lutheran campus pastor at the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon. And so my ministry is devoted to the campus, the academic scene, working with students, faculty, staff. So that's very much part of what I'm about. I also did my doctoral studies in theology, and that's why I guess I have any claim to a little more expertise perhaps than an average pastor in having done some theological reflection. I was lucky enough to study in Munich, Germany, which is not quite a spectacular setting as this, but it's right near where you can get into some beautiful Alps like this, so this reminds me very much of our territory in Bavaria. And I'd just like to go around at least one time just to hear names so we know who's who. All right, now that you know everybody's name, freely use first names, like, hey, you. yeah, the theme I'd like to deal with this morning in 25 words or less, which isn't too pretentious to talk about God in 1 hour and solve that one. Specifically, I'd like to get into the whole matter of our conceptions or our experiences of God. And I guess my thought behind that is, or my feeling, is that many times people have questions about God, or even some negative feelings about God, or are entirely turned off about God from the perspective of God that they've gotten from some set of experiences in their background or whatever. And it may have nothing to do with the God that we Christians are trying to relate to grow in relationship with. I guess in a sense I'd have to say I'm an atheist. That is, there's a God I don't believe in. And that's not original, because there's a fella named Juan Arias, a priest from South America, who wrote a book entitled The God I Don't Believe In. And so what I'd like to do to start off, and given the size of group, I didn't make too many of these, so we'll have to kind of share, but he gives a list of a whole bunch of different descriptions of the kinds of God he can't believe in. What I'd like you to do is look at this just for a little bit and see which ones particularly hit home to you. That is, which pictures or views of God that he mentions that ring bells with you that you also can't believe in, or the real turnoffs to God that that you've experienced or run across in your own life. So I guess if we can just kind of work where we are, get in probably twos. I think I've got 10 copies of this thing, so if we work in twos, I think we'll cover it. But he mentions a bunch of different descriptions of God, like, I can never believe in a God who loves pain, or a God who is a magician and a sorcerer, a God who doesn't need people, that kind of thing, okay? And what I want you to do, as I say, is to try and pick up on those and say, you know, which ones really ring bells with me? Which are the kinds of God I can't believe in either? And then we'll go from there. So if, let's see, if we can just get some people gathered around, kind of pull together. Just spend a couple minutes looking at this list, if we may. Maybe you can sit in with him, because it might end up being we'll have to go three on some of his particular grievances with Catholic perspectives on God. But I think a lot of them are pretty general Christian kinds of ideas of God.
Thanks. Gee.
We can start to back together. How did this strike you? Ring some bells with you? Your own experiences or your own feelings about God? Just like to maybe get a few up on the board. Which ones were bothersome for you? particularly? Name one, just your top one, say.
The God who stifles earthly reform and gives hope only for the future life.
Stifles?
Earthly reform.
Okay. Let's see, the God who, we'll just say. Okay, something like that. The God who isn't interested in life right here. Okay, another one. Yeah.
The God adored by those who are capable of condemning a man to death.
Okay. God who likes capital punishment, huh?
That's it.
They cite Bible passages to prove
struggle
that.
It goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Any others?
The God yeah. in whom there are no mysteries.
Okay. If you've memorized all the attributes in the catechism, you've got them right in a box. Huh? Okay.
How about the God who makes himself dear?
Okay. God who makes himself feared. All right.
Who is no bigger than we are.
Okay. All right.
God who loves pain.
God who loves pain. That really bothers you. Okay. When you see all these disasters around the world, you're saying God really is the one who's into those. Huh? He likes to see people starve and reminds us of how much we've got. And, yeah. Okay, some others.
God who loves 100% on each examination.
Okay, 100% God. Huh? Yeah, yeah. Okay, there's another fellow who wrote a book. In fact, it's entitled Your God is Too Small. A fellow named of J.B. Phillips. I don't know if you ever read that one or heard of that book, Your God is Too Small. Phillips also lists a few that I think are kind of good, and I think they're touched on here. He has kind of different pictures of God, and one of them is his resident policeman, he calls him. The God who is the resident policeman. Probably ties in with capital punishment. The God who likes to use capital punishment too. Or the God who demands 100%. He's talking about the judging God. The God who is always condemning us, constantly watching, and he's going to zap you. I think there's one in there that Arius uses, the God who says, you're going to pay, you know, God will get you, kind of thing. That kind of a God. Or another one he uses, the God of, who is the parental hangover. And I don't know if you can picture what this God does. What would you think? Who's the God of the parental hangover, according to Phillips, would you suspect?
When it lays down all the rules.
Right, right. The big, heavy guilt trip, huh? The guilt trip in the sky. Anything you're doing, you know, if it's fun, enjoyable, or tasty, it's sin. You know, automatically, God is there judging, again, giving guilt trips, right? Yeah, I think that's another one that people say, you know, if that's what God is about, I can't believe in him. If God is a God who only wants to be feared and can't be loved and felt close to, I can't believe in him. If he's a God who demands 100% all the time, that's a God I can't believe in. Another one is his image of God as the, what do they call it, the managing director. And this is the God who is just up there, way up above, you know, beyond our reach, who is kind of running all the big affairs of the universe, and he's too busy to be involved with our personal lives, huh? The God who is untouchable, way off somewhere. I guess those are the kind of things, the, or another one is the, the escapist kind of God. He calls him the God of the heavenly bosom. The God you run to when you're under fire in the foxholes and things are going tough. Then suddenly, aha, there's a God. He says, no, that's not a very adequate view of God. If that's all God is, then it's very hard to believe in him for the time when you're not under the gun and life is going all right. I guess what we're getting at here is some of those kinds of perceptions or ideas about God, which I think are so limiting and rightly turn people off. Because if you keep having an experience of God as a big judge, if you keep having an experience of God as laying a guilt trip on you, if you keep experiencing God as some sort of great being off in the eternal wherever, very hard to get in touch with that kind of God. Very hard to feel any sort of rapport or personal experience with that kind of God. Say the mystery is kind of gone, huh? There's no more mystery when it's just some sort of something else. And I guess that's why I would say, in a sense, I'm an atheist too, because if people start perceiving God in that kind of way, if that's the way you learn about God in Sunday school or church or wherever, then it's no surprise to me, and I run into a lot of students who are in this precise bag, It's no surprise to me that they've said, well, if that's what God is about, I don't buy it. I'm an atheist. If that's what it means to believe in God, to go to church every morning or every Sunday morning, to get beat over the head and told that I'm no good and I ought to feel guilty, or told that, you know, there's a pie in the sky by and by, somewhere in the hereafter, you know, just wait for it, then I can't buy that. If God isn't more real in my life than that, if God isn't more part of the reality of my everyday struggles for existence, then I can't believe in him. And people do turn off God on that kind of basis, which, as I say, I think is very sad, but in my experience, and I think maybe in some of yours too, this is where it's at. Interesting for us Lutherans in particular, I think, is if you just look at our catechetical descriptions of God, huh? Talk about turnoffs, talk about setting it up for finding it very hard to relate to that God. What are the ones? Do you remember from your catechetical days, description of God? Remember that section on God, the attributes of God? Huh? What were they? Remember? Anybody? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that far back for some of you.
Omnipotent, omniscient,
yeah. Yeah, all right, let's get these big words, okay. Omnipotent. Omniscient. Omnipresent, right? That was another one. What's some of the others? Holy, you say? All holy, yes, right. What are the others? Eternal? Hmm? And what's the other one that goes along with that hymn? Eternal.
Invisible.
Unchangeable was another one. That's what I was thinking of. Okay, those are some things which come out of our immediate Lutheran kinds of experiences as we describe God, right? Now we would say, well, that's inadequate. If you're not getting God in that, you're not getting God in anything. See, I mean, when you say omniscient, omnipotent, you're saying that's all there is. Except, what comes across to you when you start seeing these kind of descriptions?
Power.
Okay, one thing is power, right?
Unapproachable.
Okay, well, yeah, let's translate some of these. Yeah, omnipotent is power way over my head, huh? Okay. He knows everything. How does that translate? Well, I guess another one here that I think fits is determinist, huh? If God is all-powerful, that means he determines everything. But then, over here in parentheses, we have to say, what about evil? Huh? And then we have a little problem with that. You know, if God is all-powerful, why? Okay, omniscient, what does that translate to in your head?
Better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, right?
Yeah, right. Evil eye is on you. And you won't get any goodies at Christmas if you mess up. Okay, right. Omnipresent. What does that mean?
Everywhere, all the time.
Everywhere, all the time. Okay, but let's translate that a little more to our experiences.
Can't hide.
Everywhere.
Can't hide.
Yeah, okay. Kind of maybe reinforcing some of that, that if he knows everything, geez, what can we get away with, huh? Okay, you can't beat the judge, all right? That's what that translates to. He's everywhere, so you can't beat the judge. He's all holy.
You can't understand?
Okay, yeah. let me see. Let's say insensitive. Eternal. Out of touch? I mean, if he's eternal, how can he be in touch with now? So kind of an out-of-touch God. Unchangeable.
Inflexible.
Inflexible. All right, that's getting a little closer to home. Inflexible. Heavens, how can he begin to experience my situation, you know, when things have to be exactly the way they are? Invisible?
Unseeable.
Unreal. Huh? Unreal? Huh? Okay. Where is he? When I need him, right now. Where is he? Okay. Yeah, I guess that to me is the payoff of a lot of the way we've approached our views of God in catechism and in our church studies. Is that we try and use all these terms, these neat categories, to try and list God. But what happens in the process is, first of all, God becomes just a bunch of these attributes that you're supposed to memorize in order to get to the communion. If you're under the old system anyway. And even worse than that, these things come across sounding like God is a big, again, a judge, constantly watching us, controlling the whole universe, almost leaving no room for our own individual lives or power or energies. Even scarier, he's knowing all your thoughts so that you can't even blow it in your mind, but what he's there, with the implication being that you're going to pay for that. He's going to get you for that. The sense of God's unrealness, that all these things sound like, well, that's just a God way off there, that you can, you know, he's all these things. You can put a bunch of labels on him, but he's an eternal, unchangeable God. And I guess those kinds of descriptions of God already put him out of touch for a lot of people. And I would say he put him out of touch for me. If God isn't more than that for me, then I have a real hard time with that. And so I guess that's why I appreciate some of the talk that's going on in theology today about some alternative ways of looking at God. God who becomes more real, more part of our experience of life. And I think that's so crucial for us to see that other way. But before we do that, I don't know, I guess I want to read so far here. Is this making sense to you, the kind of things we're talking about? Does that fit your experience, that you have difficulties with some of these conceptions of God? Yeah.
I can't see how you can say all these things that he's unreal and you can't see him. When, you know, you look around and you see the mountains and all the beauty and look at yourself, you wouldn't be here without him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't see how you can say that. But I understand, you know, that's your opinion. But I can see that too.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's where I'm at. I'm saying I feel that's part of my experience of God as I ran through this catechism stuff and as I sat through a lot of sermons in my younger days and so on. I guess that's some of the things that came across. The preacher was talking love, but what was coming through behind his words was a lot of judgment and guilt and stuff like that, that at least hit me very close to home, a lot closer than the words love, that attitude. Or the sense of God being so high and holy and therefore unapproachable. You know, that was that was part of my experience too, I guess. And I'm just interested whether that's any of the rest of yours. Apparently you've gotten beyond that, which is neat, which is good.
I think you, after a while, as your learning process goes on, which is a good reason to continue learning, then you pick out what you want out of these things. You eliminate the things that you don't agree with, and you pick out what you want. You use that in your life.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I think also in the process of taking what we learned in Sunday school, etc., and I went to a church college also, in the process of living a long time after that, I've substituted a lot of different words that mean something to me for those words.
Mm-hmm.
And words that mean something to me describe a person. And the relationship that I have is a personal relationship, and those words are not personal words to me. They're kind of categorical things, which
right.
were a useful step along the way. But I think in order to have integrated that into my person, I had to find words that meant something to me in a personal way, describing a person of God.
Right.
And that's right. where I came out.
That's a real good point. Yeah, that all these categories, if you look at them, make God kind of just a static entity out here that isn't very personal or very personable, very lovable at all, is it? And yet, our Christian concept of God says that God, before anything else, is a God of love. Sure. Sure.
Now, I can go backwards now and say I believe all those things about Him, but I had to find out what other words meant first.
Right.
And go back and say, aha,
okay.
Now I know why He's omnipotent, etc. Because I've experienced places in my life where He has been, and I felt that.
Mm-hmm.
And then those words begin to mean something, but it's gone backwards.
I think,
very good.
I think part of this too is like I studied some math when I was in school, and the further I got along in math, the more I found out how the manipulations of numbers that I had done in grade school was something like a machine.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't know who had built the machine, and I didn't need to know, because if you pull certain levers, the things happen. And then when I got into college math, I began to find out about some of the people who had built some of these machines, and also there were some alternative machines and so forth and so on. And I sort of think this is like that too, you know. You're talking about a teaching method, and how do you go about teaching? It's a real problem. One way is you can sort of present a system and teach people to pull certain levers, and later on they might get far enough to figure out that that is a man-made machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true, because this is a whole series that comes out of scholastic theology, actually. This comes out of a medieval system of teaching about God, really, and was picked up by Lutherans in the time of the Reformation. They kept using them. And I guess you're right, you know, when you stop and look at it, if you take it in the best sense, certainly we believe that God is powerful, and He's a lot more powerful than we are. I mean, what all powerful means is a tough thing, kind of boggles your mind. But at least He's a heck of a lot more powerful than you and I, if He's God. That somehow He knows more than we do. Yeah, we need to affirm that. A lot of these things I think we would affirm about God, but it's still a problem of God becoming real for us in our lives. And I guess that's the real problem I have with a lot of the perceptions that we get, not only from the catechism necessarily, but I guess from our experiences in church. And to see God as a more real God for us, a more involved God, involved in our lives, involved in the processes of our lives and of history, a God who actually cares about me personally. That's what we have to be getting towards. And I guess the fact that you're here says that somehow you've gotten beyond the impersonal system and have read behind the system and said, what's the reality there for me? Yeah. There's a few theologians who are doing some things like this today, trying to at least conceptually give us a little better picture of... No, that's not quite it. It's 10:30, isn't it?
Coffee. It's coffee break.
At 10:30, I think, is coffee break, yeah. Give me a little while, please. We just got started. We've only just begun. One is Paul Tillich. I don't know if you ever heard of Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich described God, in order to get God, rather than being the God, You know, I have difficulty, so I'm going to try something. And that is to write while I'm sitting down here, because I hate trying to look under this thing. If I were a midget, I'd be fine. But Paul Tillich tried to conceptualize God with a different kind of system, if you will. Get him out of being this God out there that we hang a bunch of labels on, eternal, unchangeable, omnipotent, overpowering. And so he called God the ground of being. Okay, so instead of the God out there, he's the God under us. He's the foundation for our lives. That's Tillich's way of trying to get beyond the God who is somehow remote from us, the God who can't appreciate the nitty-gritty of my life. And so the way he says is God is the foundation. He's the ground of all of our being, of all of our existence. And so you don't look for God somehow beyond our everyday experiences, but you look for the power of God precisely within the experience of the everyday. So that transcendence isn't a matter of the future way out there or the above way up there somewhere, to use conceptual ideas, but that transcendence or the reality of God is something that you find right in the everyday. In other words, it happens where people interact. There's some spark which is the more in the relationships between people, and that's what God is all about. Tillich tried to do it that way. A fellow named Alfred North Whitehead used what he called process theology or philosophy, and well, just to use the same term, God is a process. God isn't some sort of static reality that just kind of exists for itself out there or even under, but God is in a process of growing. And it's really a neat concept, because what it's saying is that God is moving with us in history. God is part of what's happening. And so, well, he uses the idea of God as dipolar. In the one sense, God is eternal, but in the other sense, in for us, God is also temporal. That is, God is historical. God is waiting for us to make a move. And what this suggests is that God is somehow interdependent with us. Huh? Which is kind of a different picture than we get sometimes of our traditional views of God. To really feel that God is, you know, waiting for us to make a move in history, and that what happens to God depends on what we do. The picture I like is a picture of the prodigal son. I don't know if you remember that story. Most fantastic, to me, the most fantastic gospel story in the whole gospel. If you want to talk about what God is really like, the prodigal son. Well, anyway, part of that story, if you stop and think of it, is that the father stays home, right, and the son goes out. Now, that father is waiting on the son, right? Now, the father goes on, and his household continues, and the other son keeps living with them, even if that other son should stay in the pigsty and die there. But if he does, then the father will not have the opportunity to run out and meet him and welcome him home, see? And so the story really depends on that son coming home, see? In other words, God, the Father, depends on humanity, the fallen son, the prodigal. There's an interdependence there. The son obviously needs the father. That's why he finally comes home and he says, boy, I've got to get it back together. I need this guy. This is stupid for me about here in a pigsty. Where it's at is with my father. But the father, is, you know, we can picture, it's not described specifically in the Bible, we can picture the father saying, geez, I hope the son comes home. I really miss that guy, you know. Wish he could come back. And he does. He's interdependent. He depends on that son. And then when he does come, he runs out and greets him and all those beautiful things which we hear about grace. Okay? But what that's saying is that there is a process. God is moving in history, the Father is moving in history, and the Son is moving in history. And I would say that's really where it's at for us too. And that's what I think Whitehead, by talking about God as process, is saying. Now, this isn't to negate that God is, in a sense, all-knowing, but it's saying that as far as we're concerned, there's a sense in which God doesn't know. See? There's a sense in which the Father, if he really gives human beings choice, does not know whether the Son's going to come back from the pigsty or not. He's hoping he will. He wants him to. His whole purpose and his whole destiny for that Son is that he should have grown up to be a good boy, stay home, work on a farm, be happy, inherit eternal life, etc. But he didn't choose to. He went off to the far country, and so the father waits. That really says that there's a question mark until the son comes home. Then the father has a chance to welcome him again. But there's a question mark in God's future in that sense too. Okay? I think there's to me there's something about that really puts God into relationship with us in a neat kind of way that I don't find in the old static concepts that you find in the catechism or that I learned in Sunday school. To say that God actually depends on me, that if somebody's going to be fed and clothed and healed, I've got to do it. If there's going to be love happening in the world, I've got to do it. See? Obviously, I only draw that source to do it through the relationship with the Father. But at the same time, he doesn't somehow come down automatically and zap people in the middle of Africa and say, aha, Jesus loves you. It only comes through you and me who love and care for each other and share the good news of God with other people. God is dependent on us. There's an interdependence in history as God and us move together, growing through history. An interaction. Really a beautiful picture of walking together, of God walking with us on the way. God is dependent on us. There's an interdependence in history as God and us move together, growing through history. An interaction. Really a beautiful picture of walking together, of God walking with us on the way. And again, that's not a picture I got in Sunday school. I don't know if you did, but it to me it's really helpful to perceive God as really walking with me, relating to me every day, depending on what happens with humanity. Then you start to plug into some of those Old Testament pictures, you know, of God who really weeps over his people. God who really gets angry with his people. Why? Because God is walking the way, and it hurts when he sees the sun go off into the far country. And it hurts when he sees his people follow false gods and into idolatry. And it makes him happy when he sees them come home again. You see, there's joy and there's sorrow. There's experiences, there's a future, there's an openness, there's a question mark for God. Now that's another side to God, it seems to me. That's another side than talking about God as eternal, unchangeable, all-knowing. See, those kind of things don't seem to jive. Because you say, well, God, if God is all-knowing, how can he wait for the sun to come home? He knows the sun is going to come home. I'm saying there's a very real sense in which God doesn't know what's around the corner. And he's waiting. Because he has given us that kind of creativity. He has given us the power to make some choices. And he's going to live with those choices, just like we have to live with those choices. Huh? That's a scary thought, but it's also kind of neat. Because that means that we're not just little robots running around in this world, pretending like we're making choices, but really, the great man up in the sky is pulling all the strings and it's happening exactly the way he wants. No. There is no great man in the sky in that sense. He's the Father walking with us on the way, and he's waiting to see what our next move is. And he's given us some ideas of what he'd like the moves to be. The clearest picture he's given us of what kind of moves he'd like to see are given in Jesus Christ. He says, you want to see some body moves? Look at that guy. See, that's his clearest word to us of what God would like us to be doing in this world. But he can't guarantee it's going to happen, see? In fact, that son of his, Jesus, was the only totally obedient one. He could count on him to do the loving thing. But with us, always a question mark for God. Now, what is eternal about God is that he'll survive no matter what we do. We may blow ourselves to kingdom come, but God will still be there. He'll cry a lot, though, because he'll really miss us. I believe that. Because he has put some eggs in our basket. He has invested in us. Invested an awful lot. Invested enough to dare to give us choice. Choice to kick him in the shins. Turn around and one quick one. You know, that's amazing that the Almighty God, you know, use one of those big terms again, the Almighty God gives us the creative power to say, I don't believe in God. Isn't that amazing? You know, what dog turns around and says, well, I don't believe in my creator? Ever see a bear or a wolf run around here saying, I don't believe in God? No, but human beings somehow can make that neat move of saying, well, no, I don't think there's a God. Psst, go away, you know, I'm just going to live with the here and now. Fascinating thought. To God, for God to give us that kind of choice, that tremendous possibility of either responding to him or rejecting him. But it's only if we see it in this kind of interdependence, it seems to me, that the whole Christian approach comes to life. The sense of incarnation, of God being in the flesh, of God being with us. Then it really makes sense. Another whole approach is future-oriented theology. Probably its best exponent is Fellow named Wolfhard Pannenberg. Talks about God as the power of the future. That God opens up the future to us. What I like about that image is that it takes the dynamics of history and it turns them around. I think a lot of the way people understand history is sort of like God having wound up a clock and it's sort of ticking and unfolding in its natural course, you know, and what's happening is just kind of a natural unfolding of what happened before. What this particular move does is say, no, rather than, you know, history's going along and you know, it's happening and God is somehow helping to make it happen through here. He's saying, no, God is the power opening up every future, every moment of our future. Which says that God is constantly relating to you and me, meeting us, confronting us totally, so that every moment is a new possibility in our life. It means that nobody is doomed to be what they've been before. I'm not doomed to be what I've been before. I'm not doomed to my old bad habits. I'm not doomed to the present situation. That there are new possibilities for my life in every moment. In fact, the whole universe, Pannenberg would suggest, is not just a habit. Even though we can find scientifically quite a bit of regularity in the way the atoms keep this building going and so on, actually there's a new moment for every atom in the universe. And God is the one that makes that happen, makes it possible. Just like he makes our lives possible in every new moment. That means we aren't boxed in any way, but that God opens up things for us. It's kind of a sense, sort of like this, of God constantly opening doors to us, inviting us into his future, inviting us into life, to explore and to experience life. Couple of things which this particular approach does, it seems to me, it sort of relates to this other one too, because it sees God as part of history then too, huh? Because God is constantly opening up history for us. It's not just a set pattern that's going to happen, but that God is constantly opening up future the history, which is the future for us. But it also again reasserts that individuality of each one of us, the uniqueness of each one of us human beings. So God is not some disinterested thing out there. But God is one who opens up my life. God says, yeah, Norm, you can make a new move, you can meet new people, you can try new ways, you can find new reasons for living and hoping and praying and rejoicing, new ways of forgiving and healing and repairing and caring. That's the kind of God that they're suggesting. And again, that makes sense to me because I think a God who just did something back then, you know, created the world and sort of let it loose to unwind, or a God who just put Jesus in history back there somewhere and said, well, now, you know, if you look back towards him, then everything's all taken care of. It doesn't have that same kind of dynamic as if God says, no, what I've shown you in Jesus is what I want you to be living by. That's the vision. What you see in Jesus is a vision of what life ought to be about. It's the vision of the coming kingdom. That God has a sense of fullness and wholeness, of perfect love and completion intended for his world and for his people. And so what we're about is striving to find that and to grow in that. And he's opening up the doors for us every day to find that in new ways. Gives me a sense of potency. I'm not trapped. I actually can make a difference in the world. I can do some things. God is there in that process. The power of his spirit is giving me the ability to respond in new ways in my life all the time. Okay, another one that I think is, these are just some theological ways then of getting beyond this sort of a static, impersonal, unchangeable, untouchable, unreal God. ways that are used by theologians to try and make God more real, more personal, which you found in your own kinds of ways too. I guess just one other element that I'd like to name that's perhaps becoming a little more popular these days. Transcendental meditation makes it a little more popular. Hare Krishna, a few of these others, you're starting to hear about it more. Maharaji, is the whole Eastern religion and its sense of mystery. So I'd like to name it mysticism. Now this is not so much a concept. You know, these are still conceptual ways of trying to get at God. But I think what Eastern mysticism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and the things which we find around us, like transcendental meditation that spins off from these, what these are getting at is not even an alternative head trip about God, other ways of conceptually saying how God might be more real for us, but they're saying the head trip altogether is just a very small part of life. And what God is about is much more experiential, that there's a sense of the mystery, of a profound depth to the universe and to our world. And to get in touch with that is to get in touch with God. And so what they're suggesting is much more of a non-rational or non-intellectual, which is our Western way, our more Christian custom of trying to find alternative ways of talking about it. Their way is to say, seek for that depth in life through experience. Be open to mystery. Be open to new depths or profound experiences within your life. Don't be contentious with the shallow things which you can define and you can categorize. However you can categorize them, even in these categories. Mysticism, it seems to me, tends to emphasize that God is far beyond our knowing. And he's much more in touch with our experiencing, our living. And so the Eastern religions are, in general, I would say, talking more in mystical senses, talking about getting in touch with the all, the ultimate reality. And they have different systems, disciplines, by which you do this, you know, different types of yoga, different manner of meditating or contemplating, in order to get in touch with that reality. But the fact is, what they're talking about, it seems to me, is something that's also very close to us as Christians. In fact, there are Christian mystics, there have been all through history, people who have emphasized getting in touch with God in an experiential sense. And I think they have much in common. But what they're all getting at, it seems to me, is very true. At least I think there's a real truth in that, although I'm not saying that the Eastern religions are all there is, no. In fact, I think they lose that sense of the personal. That's one of the problems with the Eastern religions, is that they ultimately that the personal must be lost. And I don't think so. I think that there is an ultimate personal character to the universe and to God and to people, that our eternal existence is not impersonal, or that we somehow lose ourselves. But the concept of getting beyond our narrow limitations, our narrow personal concerns, and getting in touch with that power of the universe, which is much bigger than us. The power you find in the mountains. The power that you find in relationships. The power that's there in love. Those are things which point to that deeper mystical reality, which is God also. Yeah?
Yeah, it seemed like when you said, you know, about being in touch, that was another way of maybe talking about, or like talking about the end point of this thing of God walking with us.
Mm-hmm.
If God is really walking with me and is in me,
mm-hmm.
then there'd be that kind of a mystical thing happening. Is that
yeah, yeah, I think there's a real sense in which that's true, right. That interpenetration of God with us is certainly there. But I'm saying mysticism even tries to say, don't even worry so much about describing it conceptually, but get in touch with it really in your life. Yeah. Yeah.
I got a question about all of this in
sure.
general. Can I
sure.
ask it now? When you talk about God being there, as a personal experience, and that he's not controlling things. He actually lets us make a choice. Well, you know, how do you handle third world countries and poverty and things like that? Or it seems like it would appear that all those people, like everybody who is poor or in a third world country or something like that, are there because they want to be then, you know. If they really have anything to do with who they are and where they are, then they're there because they want to be. You know, that's the way that whole thing comes across. And okay. It seems that for people who are, say, like not within the norm of our society, which would be the poor or the handicapped or whatever, it would seem like it would be easier for people like that to handle sort of like a, how did you describe it, a clock thing, like under over type thing, wind up the clock in the sky type thing. Seem like it would be easier for people like this to handle that kind of a God much easier, because it would be like, okay, he wind up the clock and let it go, and where we are, it's like destiny, and you know, maybe it's just our fate in life to be poor, or to be hungry, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I can't. All the things you mentioned, you know, sounds good for, you know, if you happen to be on the more, on the better half of, or within the norm of American life. But seem like if you're outside of the norm, where you are poor and you are hungry and you do see people die all the time, it doesn't seem to
fit. Doesn't fit.
Yeah. Is there?
Okay.
It sounds a lot like the going kerygma of the day, that whole make your own kind of music type thing, like in control of your destiny type thing. That's the way it came across to me.
I was going to say something similar. I think that's good to have different ways of thinking about God, but it seems like you have to be awfully careful. But as far as getting it too man-centered, I mean, the whole thing of I found it and all this kind of stuff, it gets at so much basis of the spotlight all on man and off of God. I think we really have to expand, and some of these old ways haven't done it either. That's not the answer, but I think there's some big question marks about the new ways too.
Yeah.
And, just so we're open to not saying this has to be the way or is the
right
way.
Right. Yeah, I'm just starting from a particular problem. As I said, some of the sense in which God can be expanded, and I'm just saying that these are some ways in which maybe we can expand our experience of God. I think, yeah, another whole direction is that, that's another whole bag, the whole question of, well, it's called liberation theology today, how we relate God to the people who are really in suppressed and in bondage situations of various kinds, right? Yeah, this is speaking very much to people, as I said, who come out of this kind of experience. A lot of people who haven't come out of that experience maybe wouldn't appreciate that, that kind of this sort of a God becoming more real. I guess I am talking to us and our experiences, how it can become more real for us. And I'm reflecting my kind of situation where I'm dealing with a lot of people, and I guess, yeah, the better half of the world, if you will, or upper, less than a half, it's the upper fifth of the world or something. But that, right, that that could be misconstrued, and I certainly wouldn't want to do that, to mean that somehow God wants people or thinks people should want to be where they're at. No, I think that part of God's suffering with the world, if in fact he is a God who lives with us in history, is to also hurt very much for those who are sick and who are poor and those who are suppressed in a variety of ways in this world. Part of what it seems to me then to say to us is that precisely those of us who are in a position to have any potency at all ought to be looking at the needs of those who are poor and who are handicapped and who are the dispossessed. That seems to me to be the challenge of the gospel. If in fact God is a God of love, what does it mean then for us to love? If we're going to be the arms and the legs of love, of the love of God in this world, then those have got to be the objects, not only one another, but it's got to be also those who are hurting around us in a variety of ways. Yeah. So yeah. I
think that part of it is excellent, because I think there'll be some real surprises when we get to heaven, as far as, I mean, why certain things are a certain way. I think instead of, I mean, I think it's going to be turned around, and we're going to say, you know, why didn't you do something? Or, you know, I think it's going to be more in that direction. And so that part of the whole process thing, that God is, you know, interdependent with us. And that's an excellent thought, because I think a lot of people don't think of their religion in those terms, that they have some responsibilities, that they need to pay some rent for the space they're occupying in the world and do something.
Part of the cash value of something like this sense of God as the process in history means that we take responsibility for history. And we don't say, well, if the poor are poor, it's because that's the way God made it. See? Now, like you say, maybe it's easier for the poor to accept it that way, because once they start finding out that they're not poor because God made them that way, but because we're ripping them off, that could get unpleasant for us, the upper one-fifth of the world. And I think, you know, we very fittingly ought to be feeling uncomfortable already, before they even put us in that spot. Christians ought to be feeling uncomfortable about people starving in this world, and people being put down and suppressed systematically in this world. That to me is what the gospel is about for this world too. Reform in this world, if you will. That God is not just the God of the hereafter, but if he is in fact a part of the history of life, then he's got to be part of the way we look at our responsibility to the people around us, in a narrow sense and in the broader global sense. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if a blending of the two could be illustrated. I have a sister who has MS and is in a wheelchair, quite enabled much of the time. I see her having sort of blended the process idea of the interdependence and the unchangeableness of God's love in dealing with that, in that she does not expect God to whop her and say, okay, tomorrow you're going to be fine again.
Right.
But she never doubts that his will for her is to be well. But her process, her problem, or her part of the process, is that she's got to be the one that works those toes. And she's got to be the one that pushes herself out of that wheelchair.
Yeah.
But she gets that power and the ability to keep trying through her complete faith in the unchangeable love of God and that what he wants for her. So I see that interdependence coming there a bit. She takes full responsibility for her part of that.
Yeah.
And yet relies very heavily on the fact that the healing will come from God if it comes. But she's got a part to play in that.
Right.
So I don't know whether that's kind of
a... Fits very well. You bet.
Going together.
Fits very well. And yeah, and I think that's, you know, that is, to me, a more pertinent kind of solution to how, you know, how God is real and significant in her life. Rather than saying, well, God fated me to be this way, so I'll sit back in my chair and wait until he heals me in the kingdom beyond, when all healing will take place. Rather to say, well, if that's what God's intention is for my life, then I've got to buy in on healing right now and do the most with my life that I can right now. Yeah. And not expect that, oh, I'll have to wait until the hereafter. Or the alternative is that we do is we see God as the magician in the sky and kind of pray, God, please, you know, make something happen, sort of, you know, like out of the ordinary. I really feel that there's a little saying that I like, that I feel is very true. Pray as if it all depends on God, and live as if it all depends on you. You know, which recognizes the transcendence of God. Yeah. I'm not trying to collapse the transcendence of God. You know, God is that power. If there's any power that makes life meaningful, that makes it go, the power that gives the atom its next, you know, split second of existence, that is the power of the universe. That is God. That is the ultimate reality. That is that eternal, unchangeable, omnipotent, omniscient being. Sure, but at the same time, that God is very closely connected to my life, and that's why I can draw on him. See? Because then if I say, well, I'm an atheist, and I'll just be a good humanist and try and help people the best I can, I ask, why? Where's your power source, and where are you going with it? Why heal people when they're just going to get sick and die and there's nothing for them? See? The Christian says, I heal because that's a sign of God's healing. And God is about healing in this whole world. You know, Jesus healed a lot of people who had to get sick and die again. You might ask, well, was that kind of vain? Was he a magician? He just liked to impress people with a few neat tricks? Or wasn't it futile because the guy he raised from the dead is going to die? No, because those were signs of the coming kingdom, Jesus said. Healing and caring. and loving for people, that is plugging in on what God's ultimate destiny for all of us is. Healing and caring and loving and justice and peace and fulfillment. That's what God's whole universe is tending towards. That's what he wants to have happen. And he says if you're a Christian, you buy in on that vision now. You don't wait for it to happen then. You buy in on it right now. And so Jesus, in the midst of his world, you know, in his little space, and he didn't run all over the world healing everybody in the world. In his little space and time, he said, I'm making the kingdom happen right here. I buy in on healing people when they're hurting. I buy in on forgiving the dispossessed and the disenfranchised. I buy in on feeding those who are hungry right now, because that's what my Father's kingdom is all about, and that's what his world is supposed to be all about. So it makes it very real. Well, yeah.
I guess I have to think of God in control. You mentioned a little while ago,
mm-hmm.
Not really considering God in complete control, but I guess I have to think of him in complete control of the whole thing. Otherwise, I don't think I could get down to the basics of faith and hope and love for the handicapped, for the retarded, who can't choose and decide for themselves, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't see any other way that got there, but God in control of these.
Yeah, you know, again, it's not a black or white. Certainly there's a sense in which God is in control. I mean, every atom draws its sustenance from God. You know, he is the life force. All life, all reality depends on God. But there's another sense in which, as I say, in our historical human life, God is interdependent, and that's the sense in which I mean it, the sense in which her sister works with MS. Not that he isn't ultimately in control, not that ultimately it isn't going to be his world, it is, yeah. But that can't be for us some sort of a cop-out or an escape, but rather a challenge to say, how can I really deal with my world in a constructive way with the energies that God has really given to me to make a difference, you know? That the person who I see laying there isn't destined to lay there and die if I can reach in and care for him somehow. See? That's got to be the basis for our motivation to do anything. Otherwise, you lay back and say, well, you do it, God. See, and nobody really does that, but I mean, that kind of mentality can be more or less there if you really feel God is in total control, you know, and he'll kind of move me. Because some evangelical folks I have difficulty tuning in on, because they talk that way, you know, I'm just going to wait and Jesus is going to do it all for me, you know, he's going to take my life or something. And I know what they mean, because they end up doing things themselves too, but they talk in that terminology, you know, which says, you know, I gave up everything and I put God in control of my life and I let go. And then, you know, they somehow expect God's going to drop a job in front of them and he's going to move them over here and he's going to put the next meal in their mouth and lift up the fork. And I don't buy that, you know. And they don't really either, because they move the fork. They do. But they talk in that term, in that kind of terminology, and a little difficulty with that. Because really, God puts us, in a sense, in control of our lives. As I say, the prodigal son, you know, that father let him have control. He gave him the money and let him go, see. Father doesn't do that with the cattle. The cattle stay in a barn where he made them and he puts them. But for some reason, the son, us human beings, he gives that tremendous power to truly make choices and live with them and die with them. As you say, on Judgment Day, you know, he'll start asking, what kind of choices did you make? Hey, I didn't twist your arm to love me. I invited you. Kind of a scary proposition, but as I say, I think it's also freeing. Well, we're done. Thank you.